Good morning, Your Honors.
My name is Gretchen Helfrich, and I represent the appellant Fred Dowell in this matter. Fred Dowell made a plea agreement with the government, and in that agreement he reserved one issue for direct appeal. He reserved the right to appeal the district court's finding that he was a career offender under the United States sentencing guidelines. He instructed his counsel to file a notice of that appeal, and his counsel failed to do so. That is ineffective assistance of counsel, per se, under Gantt.
You say he expected counsel to do that, but his counsel said he didn't ask him to do that, right?
Well, his counsel has said that the statement Dowell made in a letter to the court that was considered a notice of appeal and his motion for enlargement of time were inaccurate. But Dowell made a number of statements in that letter and in his motion that had to do with when he asked, had to do with when he found out the notice wasn't filed. So the trial counsel, Golden, hasn't really clarified what exactly he said was inaccurate. But if I may, I'd also like to point out that he's...
So if we agree with you there was no waiver, is the best course for us to remand for an evidentiary hearing as to whether Dowell instructed his attorney to file the notice, since we don't have any determination yet as to whether or not Dowell's assertion was truthful?
That would be one. If you feel that the record doesn't sustain the claim on its own, then yes, the remand for an evidentiary hearing on Dowell's assertion would be the appropriate course of action.
The district court judge never even got to that issue, right?
That's right. The district court judge found that the waiver barred the claim, but the collateral attack waiver in Dowell's plea agreement. But in this court, a collateral attack waiver is only enforceable to the extent of its scope. And this claim falls outside the scope of that waiver. And it has to fall outside the scope of that waiver for two reasons. First of all, under Vega, a plea agreement has to be interpreted according to the reasonable expectations of the parties at the time the agreement was entered into. Now, at the time the parties made this agreement, which included this reservation of a right to appeal, the reasonable expectations were that Dowell would take the appeal of the career offender finding. So the collateral attack waiver, in which he agrees not to bring a collateral attack on the sentence, refers to a sentence that was reviewed, appealed, and reviewed to the extent of the career offender finding. That's what the parties expected would happen. What actually happened was outside the expectations. In particular, it was outside Dowell's expectations for sure, because it would have been completely unreasonable for him to enter into an agreement where, in one sentence of the agreement, he reserves a right to appeal the career offender finding, only to agree in the next sentence that right can be completely wiped out by his counsel's failure to file the notice. So under Vega, this has to be outside the scope of the agreement. But in addition, under Woods, reading the text of the agreement and the plea colloquy together, we have to also find that it falls outside the scope of the agreement. First of all, the text of the waivers, there are two waivers. There's the direct appeal waiver, in which he waived direct appeal rights excluding the career offender finding. And then there's the waiver of collateral attack. Those two provisions have to be read together. And the reason is that in reserving the right to appeal the career offender finding, for that right to mean anything, for that term in the contract to mean anything, it has to include the right to have the assistance of counsel in commencing the appeal. So as a result, that in itself has to act as a limitation on the collateral attack waiver. Because without the right to the assistance of counsel in commencing the appeal, how could he take this direct appeal? That view of the meaning of the waiver was reinforced at the plea colloquy. When the judge read the terms of the waivers to Dowell, he said twice. He said, so this means you've waived your right to appeal except that career offender finding. Is that your understanding? And Dowell said yes. There was nothing to alert Dowell to the idea that he had made an agreement under which his counsel's failure to turn around and file the notice of appeal would have completely eliminated his right to take this direct appeal. So for both of those reasons, this claim has to fall outside the scope of that waiver. Now, the government hasn't addressed these arguments. It hasn't explained why the waivers work or don't work together, why you would read them separately. It hasn't explained why it's all right to read this contract in a way that results in essentially an absurdity, a reserved right that ends up being completely illusory because in the next sentence it just gets wiped out like that by counsel's failure to file. And their presentation of the plea colloquy leaves...
certainly the judge didn't have any discussion of that latter paragraph to discuss the sort of the dissonance in the agreement.
No, he didn't. He didn't. When he explained in his... He read the terms of the waiver, but when he explained them to Dowell in his own plain language explanation, he said, you've waived the right to appeal except this career offender finding. So nothing in that colloquy would have put Dowell on notice that there was this essentially booby trap in the next paragraph of the waiver. So the government's version of the plea colloquy, however, doesn't address those exchanges. They don't point out those exchanges between the judge and Dowell. So the government has offered no reason to affirm the decision of the court below. But even if the government's reading of the plea agreement is a plausible reading, there are at least two plausible readings. It is at least plausible to read the reservation of the direct appeal as a limitation on the collateral attack. And it's certainly plausible to understand sentence in the collateral attack waiver to refer to a sentence that had been reviewed to the extent of the career offender finding. So given that there are two plausible readings of the waiver, that, at a minimum, makes the waiver ambiguous. And under Quintero, that ambiguity has to be resolved against the government and in favor of Mr. Dowell. That's my argument. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Torres?
May it please the court, I'm Gerald Torres. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Southern District of Indiana representing the United States in this case. The plea agreement at issue provided that Mr. Dowell reserved the right to appeal the career offender finding, and he did not appeal that issue. The question then is, did he direct his counsel to appeal it? Mr. Dowell says yes, but his counsel has represented, no, that is not the case. But what has not been discussed is, in evaluating that question, is why would Mr. Dowell even need to appeal the career finding? Because it is true at sentencing that he was found to be a career offender, but it is also true at sentencing the judge found that that finding created too harsh of a guideline range, and he brought him down to a different range, a much lower range, something like 80 months lower, in fashioning a reasonable sentence based upon particular factors applicable to Mr. Dowell. That was done on defense counsel's urging an objection. He first discussed why he thought the career finding wouldn't apply, which was rejected by the court. And then he argued that even if the court applies it in the guideline calculation, it should vary its sentence downward to meet those factors. And it did do that. So the sentence imposed, pursuant to a very favorable plea agreement.
Yeah, but you're going to the merits of the... I mean, you're looking at what harm was going on here because he got the lower sentence, then what does it matter? I want you to focus on that language because there was a carve-out in his plea agreement, and there was no... And the court did a very good job explaining that carve-out, you know, except for the career offender status issue. And then there's language after that that seems to take the right away. There's no discussion by the court. At least that's what you're suggesting.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. You're correct when you say what the court discussed. The court really did not separate those out. The court read to Mr. Dowell the entire waiver paragraph, which contained both waivers. The court asked him if he had discussed it with his counsel, which he said they had done. In fact, I think it was very, very thoroughly discussed it. So he had, and then he told the court also that he understood the waiver directly. What the court didn't do was separate them out and discuss them separately. But Mr. Dowell did have the benefit of the court asking him whether or not he understood that, acknowledging, yes, he did. He had the benefit, which most people in contracts don't have, of having a lawyer advise him to the terms before he went into the court.
Well, of course, it's a criminal case, and so that's why we have all this. This is very different from the normal civil setting.
That is true.
That's not a big surprise you would have, counsel.
But it is a factor having to do with his understanding, that he acknowledged that he discussed it both with his counsel and then re-acknowledged it to the court that he understood it.
Yeah, but what I don't get is the court explained, you know, the right to appeal and how the carve-out was the exception to the career offender status. So you have to assume that when the later language talks about collateral attack in 2255, that he understands that it doesn't apply. That exception doesn't apply there. And the court didn't explain that to him.
No, the court did not separately explain that. That is correct. But there's no indication that he did not understand that. And he acknowledges understanding the full paragraph, and he acknowledges having discussed it thoroughly with counsel prior to being in court. There's no, in fact, issue that he didn't understand it. His dissatisfaction is his claim that counsel didn't file an appeal and his inability then to do anything about it because of the collateral attack waiver. Yes, Your Honor?
Could you explain then how that is barred by the appeal waiver, which says he cannot contest his conviction or sentence? Isn't that something totally separate beyond challenging the conviction and sentence? That being the conduct of his attorney?
Yes. I don't.
So it's not barred by the appeal waiver?
No, it is barred by the appeal waiver.
Why? Why is that within the framework of what he's given up in his appellate waiver, which is the ability to challenge his conviction or sentence?
Because they are distinct provisions, and they go to distinct aspects of the post-trial court conviction process. The collateral waiver is an unconditional waiver, and the court has held repeatedly, this court, that you may waive ineffective assistance of counsel except for ineffective assistance of counsel in the negotiation of the agreement itself. And I don't think there's any contention that the counsel was ineffective in negotiating the agreement. That's absolute. What separately was the process of appealing an issue that was reserved. And he would have had the right to do that had he elected to do so. But they are separate, and so had he appealed, you couldn't raise a waiver. He had that right. But separately, post-conviction, you could. What's to say if he had appealed it and lost, he wouldn't then bring the same issue on a post-conviction relief? And the answer is, well, he'd waived it. It would be barred. And I don't think the court would disagree with that.
So if you acknowledge that he did carve out an exception within the appeal waiver that would have allowed him to challenge his career offender status, you acknowledge that, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It seems like a right with no remedy if he had, in fact, directed his counsel to appeal it, which is in dispute, but he has no remedy for the attorney's failure to appeal that very issue. What's the point of
that? That is correct. He doesn't have he waived that as part of his negotiated plea agreement.
So there could be
a matter of finality.
There could be a per se violation of the Sixth Amendment in his attorney not filing an appeal consistent with his direction, and there's no remedy for that.
I don't think there is a remedy under those circumstances because he has received, unless you take, he has received the benefit of the plea agreement. He can't have the benefit without having the detriment. That is part of the detriment.
That just doesn't make any sense, that he would direct the lawyer. I understand it's a factual decision. It doesn't make any sense. Then when you look at what the court said, he says, pursuant to the plea agreement, you're giving up or waiving your right to appeal the conviction and sentence, in this case, to a higher court. That's his first level appeal, with the exception of the issue of career offender status. Is that your understanding? He goes, yes. But there's no warning that this appeal would be forever forfeited if his counsel failed to file a notice of appeal. And the court didn't explain that the waiver provision could prevent him from seeking any remedy if that happened. That makes no sense.
Well, I would point the court to a recent decision that it decided this year in U.S. versus Thomas, United States versus Thomas, where they say, quote, defendants who appeal from sentences following a plea agreement always point to unanticipated and unwelcome developments, unquote. This is in the context of post-conviction relief, but that's what this is. It is an unanticipated and unwelcome development, but it is what he agreed to.
Yeah, but those cases are not specifically in this type of situation.
This is a rather unique...
That's the general language of the court, but it's not in this specific factual context. Where that you were given a carve out, and yet when it wasn't filed, you have no rights whatsoever.
That is correct. It's not in that context.
But if his counsel had conceded that he did indeed fail to file when or having been asked to, does that change it?
I think it would.
How so?
That would be the situation where counsel actually had walked away from him. And that is clearly disputed in this case.
Yeah, but see, that doesn't make any sense either. So you're saying that if in the affidavit his counsel said to follow along with what Judge Kaney says, my brother, yes, he's right. He told me to appeal the career offender issue in plenty of time. I just didn't file the notice. You're saying under those circumstances, he'd be able to move forward on the 2255. I just want to make sure.
I think that that's a different situation. I think that...
I don't get that, because here the question is, it's disputed. And so the court, we can send it back for a remand so the court can find out whether he was told that, whether he wasn't told that. I don't see what the difference is.
You could send it back for a remand, but I don't even think a remand is necessary under the
But let's
facts.
Get back to but, the initial but, but question I, but, that was asked by Judge Kaney.
That's a very difficult question. Based on the language and these court holdings, perhaps he could not. He would be barred. That is not what we have, and that's a very difficult factual situation, hypothetical situation. My time is up. I'm sorry for taking too long.
Just a few points on rebuttal. If I understand the dialogue that just happened, that is exactly the situation that we are in. Dowell contends that his attorney abandoned him when he asked him to file this appeal, to take the appeal of the one issue that he reserved in his plea agreement. So we're in exactly the situation that was just described, although there's...
That's what Judge Williams had discussed about the remand, though, because we don't know for sure that that's the situation we're in.
Okay, we may not know for sure, but that's what Dowell says alleges happened. So that is the situation. That's the claim. That's the ineffective assistance claim. Two other things. The notion that a collateral attack waiver is always an absolute waiver and bars all claims is just mistaken. Jones, this court's holding in Jones, which established the enforceability of collateral attack waivers, also established that certain types of claims, including ineffective assistance with regard to the negotiation of the waiver, that certain claims always survive the waiver. They're unwaivable. But that case never said that a waiver couldn't have a more limited scope. And many cases since then, Bridgman, for example, Sines, Nunez, have all had to do with the scope of the waiver. So a particular agreement can have a collateral attack waiver with a more narrow scope. And this is one of those cases where the collateral attack waiver has to be read to have a more narrow scope. And then finally, I just want to say that there's no place in this argument for any discussion of the worth of taking an appeal, because this is a per se ineffective assistance case. He has no obligation to show that he was prejudiced by the failure to take an appeal, and certainly no obligation to show that he would have prevailed on the appeal had he been able to take it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for and did you take this case by appointment, counsel?
Yes.
And you have the thanks of the court for your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.